Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very happy to be with my guest, Carol Muskie Dukes, who has published a new novel, Channeling Mark Twain, which is published by Random House. And she is a poet as well as a novelist and an essayist as well as a poet and novelist. And I want to leap right into the subject of the book because what I feel was so impressive about this book. It's a book about a young woman named Holly who goes to teach poetry at a woman's prison, the woman's house of detention on Rikers Island. But the novel, Channeling Mark Twain, succeeds in opening all of the political and aesthetic and ethical questions that were raised in the late 1960s. And have been not so much solved, but put to bed or backburnered by the last 30 years or so. And so as I read, I remembered what it was like to live in the anguish of being asked to take myself seriously. The very first question that is raised, and it's raised in the first chapter, Holly has gone to the prison, has had her first session with the inmates, and has brought back a poem from one of them, which she shows to a very well-respected poet at a dinner party, who laughs and says, it's worthless, it's not a poem at all. And says that the entire question is whether in teaching poetry you are stimulating genius. So the question becomes, who is a poet?
That's correct. I mean, I guess that poetry, as people say, is a character in this novel. In fact, it's really a novel about poetry, and with, of course, contextualized by the time, the 70s, and all that you said, Michael, about the 70s, and a time when people did attempt to take themselves seriously without the onerous and sort of ironic take on taking oneself seriously that we have now. But in any event, that scene at the dinner party, and I should stop and say this is a semi-autobiographical, that craven term, a semi-autobiographical novel. So, yes, I did teach at the Women's House on Rikers Island. And, yes, in fact, I did show a very famous American poet who shall remain nameless this poem, and his reaction was, yes, this is a joke. He laughed. This is nothing. This is just, you know. If anything, it's a kind of document of how far away consciousnesses are, you know, about what is beautiful, what is good, etc. I think that, he believed that poetry should stimulate genius. Also, he said, I remember this very clearly, that poetry should erase the event which inspires it. And I disagree. You know, I think that poetry should render the event. And there are different ways of rendering.
You know, I have still elitist tendencies. So I was reading the chapter and saying, yes, I agree with him. I agree with him. I think that if I'm going to read a poem, it should be a work by a poet and the best work of the poet. And I remember at the time, Kenneth Koch, many others, were going various places, elementary
right.
schools, old age homes,
right.
to teach poetry writing. And I think it was James Schuyler who quipped, Kenneth Koch could teach a stone to write poetry. but then I got to
And Charlie Simic would write about it.
Then I got to the end of your chapter, and the poem appears. And I see, yeah, it's not what I'd call a good poem,
No.
But it is riveting.
Right.
It's about a woman who thought her baby could fly.
She believes her child can fly. She really believes this.
And the baby has fallen out of the window
of
and
the
is
projects,
now dead.
Right.
Of the projects. And this is a woman who is acutely disturbed in Holly's workshop. And I said, well, this is going to be a very interesting book because it's going to challenge my return to my assumptions of the past. Because, yes, I became fascinated by that woman. And if this isn't a revealing poem in itself, these poems that appear in the course of the book by the various participants in the Woman's Poetry Project in prison become fascinating people, and they mobilize the consciousness and the confusions of the narrator.
Right. Well, in fact, you know, I want to back up just a little bit. In teaching this workshop, I did see poems like that. My challenge in writing the novel was to come up with poems in my voice that approximated those voices without using their own words. I had a little anthology we had put together and so on, but I wanted to stay away from, of course, you know, using the words of anyone who I am now out of touch with, and there are only two members of the workshop about whom I have any knowledge now from that long ago time. Anyway, so trying to recreate that voice taught me, those voices taught me something about rendering the event. And it's exactly what you were saying about Elise. It's not to say that you're elite because you believe those things. My big conflict, the reason in writing this book, the reason why I couldn't get it down for so long was just that. That conflict about the nature of poetry. What is it, in fact? Is that a poem? Is that poem written by that disturbed woman, if not a poem, something approaching real writing of poetry, you know, and an attempt, like any poem, to write a perfect poem or write a poem that perfectly expresses something and has simple dramatic power in this case. So the conflict of the narrator has been my conflict. How would I write about that time when poetry meant so much to me that I actually did at one time believe that one could, I still believe, one can go in almost anywhere, prisons, hospitals, and so on, and teach poetry the same way one would teach in, you know, a university, where I was also teaching while I was teaching at Rikers Island. A little bit later, and I move it up a little bit in the novel, I was teaching at Columbia. Ultimately, the main character decides to take one of what would be called one of the most elitist, quotes, poems by one of our most, quotes, elite, one of our most elitist poets, at, you know, in the pejorative sense. It's not at all Wallace Stevens. And she takes the final soliloquy of The Interior Paramour, right? Very difficult, it seems, poem. But ultimately, I believe what brings together, or the attempt to bring together these two worlds, that is to say the world of that simple dramatic truth in poetry, in the world of so-called elitist or perfectly aesthetic poetry, is empathy. And Stevens' poem, I believe that poem is about empathy.
I'm speaking to Carol Muskie Dukes about her novel, Channeling Mark Twain. That question of empathy is the one that not only animates this novel, but is the one we're facing in our times. So that I was reminded very movingly about, well, going to meetings of bail funds where the people at the meeting are wealthy people but who are only giving the money they've collected at a bake sale.
Well, they're the children often, or at least they're privileged enough to be able to go to Columbia, and some have trust funds and so on. Yes, absolutely.
But the world of questioning privilege, which we in a sense no longer do or no longer an essential obligation that we do, that we look at privilege as being something that, if attained, is earned and not to be questioned.
Right. I mean, we've harked back to a Puritan time, but there's a moment in the novel where when Holly is in graduate school in San Francisco, there's a Berkeley professor who says, you all say there's going to be a revolution. There'll never be a revolution in the United States because everyone wants the next step up. That there's this built-in idea of privilege, yes, and that it is attainable. And if it's attainable, then ultimately you can keep ascending to that pinnacle, right? And he talks about remote access, essentially. He says, Marx says, in order to live, we must enter history. And he says, Americans will not enter history.
They
believe
want
in
to
remote
enter.
Access. Garage door openers and bombs that are remotely controlled.
So do you feel that it was a better time when these questions were like an open sore? We at least in the literary world, if we were conscious, we didn't go for more than 2 or 3 hours without being confronted by the question of the usefulness of what we were doing, the
right.
meaning of what we were doing.
Right.
What
did I think it was a better time? Even living with the open sort of rawness of
yes.
that discourse. I think so because of the fact that one was open to these things and had not closed off in the way I think that we seem to encourage now. The way the way we seek privilege, we tend to close ourselves off. We tend to think that we are not involved in the plights of others. That we can distance ourselves. It is this idea of remote access, that the professor talked about. I mean, I think that even for this character, Holly, who goes through a real trial by fire, I mean, there's also the question of when she's teaching, in the prison, she's also working as what's called an aftercare worker. I did this myself. It's sort of a, rehabilitative program. Finding jobs and maybe some educational opportunities for women once they got out of prison. And in that capacity, she meets an inmate who says that she wants to get out of prison. She wants to be furloughed. She's just been brought in, and her little girl has died the night before. She's only been there a day or so, and her little girl has died the night before. And Holly goes, takes the side of this woman, this inmate, and encourages her to – she's written a poem. This inmate encourages her to, disseminate the poem, to put it on the drum, as it's called, so that other people can read it. Anyway, can hear it. She ends up in confrontation with the warden, who educates her. And Holly has to be open to that education. She hears what she does not want to hear. And I think that at a time when we were all idealistic, or at least when we wanted to be idealistic, when we were willing to enter that great discourse of what's the meaning of one's life, what does it mean to be empathetic to others, what does it mean to care for others and be compassionate, we did not want to maybe sometimes look at the fact that we were also in a world where people were damaged and people could have an adverse effect on each other, even within the movement, so-called, even, in the anti-establishment movement. So the warden, anyway, educates her about something about this woman, which is very shocking. I won't talk about it in detail. I can if you want. But basically, Holly learns that she's been there's a narcissism to her politics. There's a kind, or maybe that's too strong a word. There's a kind of unwillingness to observe what's really happening and to balance her idealism in a way, to use it to best effect, her great energy for these causes, but not to be naive. And I think just to be open to that. A very painful experience for this character. It was for me, since it did happen to me.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Carol Muskie Dukes, author most recently of Channeling Mark Twain, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Carol Muskie Dukes about her novel, Channeling Mark Twain. Now, that chapter you're speaking of first appeared in the literary magazine Triquarterly 7 years ago, so I assume it's the seed of the novel.
It is. Exactly right.
And that this novel in particular had a very long gestation period.
Yeah.
I think it may be because it's so hard to reawaken the complexity of those issues and those problems. I remember that for me, it was, I thought, how did I get so confused back then?
Right.
But how did I get so excited? And I sometimes want to excite people now.
Right.
And I thought that step number one had been the instruction to question all received knowledge.
Right.
And that right. as soon as you started to do that and you saw how much of it was indeterminate or just habitual advice from parents who wanted to keep you safe.
And authority figures who had absolutely no sense of, you know, what they were doing.
Or what,
know, why what, they were doing it and what their knowledge was.
Or what our lives were starting to be like.
Yeah.
That is a real, they kept calling it consciousness raising and
right.
educative processes, but it took us a lot of funny thinking to be able to get.
Some of it on drugs, some not.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I still don't know whether we were screwed up or more evolved. Certainly.
Well, no, I think that. Certainly there. I mean, we were young, so that explains a lot of the screwed upness. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, you know, this. My character, this is, you're talking about a period of time when people were in their 20s. You're still so young. You're still not able, I think, to make those kinds of qualitative judgments, which come with life experience. And so, but that makes it all the richer in a way, you know, this, the power of it, the fact that somehow people, young people did it. They stood up and said, you know, I'm going to put a sign on my back and go into the streets and protest this war. I'm not going to go to this war. Or, you know, I've got a lot to say about women's rights, or I've got a lot to say about, you know, gay rights, whatever is, you know, that word, which I hate, empowering, was part of our lifestyle, part of our ongoing consciousness. Yes, they called it consciousness raising, but somehow the consciousness was sort of swelled up, you know, in almost an organic way. I'm sounding like a crazy person, I know, but in fact, it was like that. It really was. I mean, I don't even like to talk about it so much because I sound like a preacher or something, you know, and I don't mean it like that. I mean, I think that for me, the title of this novel comes from the character Polly Lyle Clement, who believes that she's the blood descendant of Mark Twain, and she channels him, in fact, believes that she can speak in his voice and so on. But I thought, because I had so much trouble writing the novel and it took me so long to feel I could enact these conflicts, you know, that we're talking about within the novel. I could actually, there's a pimp at the beginning who says, I get the whole all, and I realized I could write the whole all. I could just write about it, you know. I don't know why it took me so long to realize that, maybe because it was, you know, more autobiographical than not. But anyway, when I tried to imagine Polly Lyle Clement, I tried to imagine, what if Huck Finn came back as a young black woman in prison? That's the kind of thing that we would have imagined, right, in the 70s. Whatever.
What if Jesus came back and saw the war in Vietnam? That
right.
was
no,
a question
exactly.
we asked. Exactly.
I'm laughing, but in fact, that was not funny so much. You know, I mean, what if Huck Finn came back? What if Twain, quotes, came back and he was a black woman in prison, you know? So that helped me get the novel written.
Well, that, what I felt as I was reading it was that that very question, that moment when Huck says famously, okay, I'll go to hell.
I'll go to hell.
Was the moment that the author, my guest, Carol Muskie Dukes, was saying, okay, I'm going to write the whole thing.
Yeah.
Some of it is going to sound crazy.
Really crazy.
There are chapters here that really make you cry. There are chapters that make you mourn the death of old ideals, but recognize at the same time that the ideals weren't feasible. I mean, so this book
yeah.
is a whole and various enchilada. You know, you're moving from issue to issue and setting from set to setting. She's married. The narrator is married to a man, but she's in keeping the marriage secret because she wants it just for them. And another person who's pursuing her tells her, no, no, you want to keep it secret because you know that this isn't what you've been looking for. You
right.
want to stay open to other things. And so all of these, I mean, this character is surrounded by the problems of the culture that have, you say that reality gets transformed into a poem. I say that reality, the reality we live in, is a transformation of the reality of the 70s that you're talking about here, that we're dealing with the same issues, but we've made them look differently.
Right. We've masked them, right, effectively, or we've neutralized them somehow. Or you're right. We have, in transforming them, we've projected them onto other things. Like, what makes a person powerful? Well, a good handbag, you know, or hanging out at a club, you know, or consumer culture. Consumer culture doesn't make you powerful. I mean, I didn't advocate this, but people were, you know, they were against banks at that time. I'm not going to say people were pretty violent about banks and things. I mean, people certainly about the military. And all the things that the military industrial, you know, corporate complex that we, and I'm, you're right, they were unfeasible, those notions ultimately, right? That down that path lay ultimate freedom, only because perhaps inevitably that side would win. Is that why they were unfeasible? Because inevitably corporate culture would win and would neutralize us and essentially, you know, drug us. It's an addiction, all this stuff, you know, this, all of it, you know, that keeps us away from the real questions.
It was unfeasible, I think, because to be an idealist and at the same time take practical actions to create the state of idealism involved oppositions that tore us apart.
Well, we left, people will say we left no institutions, or the 60s, 70s left no institutions. But there was an enormous change in consciousness. There's no, you can't point to ongoing, you know, institutions. You can't point to ongoing programs that we can participate in, even centers for discourse necessarily that reflect those times. But there was an enormous change in consciousness. We wouldn't be having this conversation if it hadn't happened.
Well, I think, in fact, it was such a complex and difficult to narrate change.
Yeah.
That in the same way that it took a good number of years after
the
war in Vietnam to come to have a Vietnam novel. We kept saying the novels of World War II were almost immediate.
Yeah.
Where are the Vietnam novels? I say, where are the novels of the 60s that kind of convince us to see the realities? And I think Channeling Mark Twain is such a novel, and it took longer to write because we really were asking the impossible. You're describing such an, not just a world that's unimaginable now, but a world that we could barely imagine then.
Right. We could barely imagine. That's just it. You said there was no way to narrate it. First, you have to be able to totally imagine something in order to narrate it, right? To find a way to tell the story, it means that you have to know what the story is. We didn't know where we were going, which is why there aren't institutions, I guess. But yet, you know, we were the story. I know that sounds really, you know, again, narcissistic, but it wasn't. We were the story.
My final question is about what follows this novel, i.e. the world we're living in. There are hints throughout the book that the speaker is writing it years later, but it's not brought to the surface. I wanted to conclude by asking you how one functions in the wake of destroyed ideals, or how one keeps what version of the ideals one is capable of keeping alive?
That's an impossible question, but I think one, if one is oneself, that is to say, if you're asking me directly, I think that...
I'm asking you directly.
I know you are. I was trying to evade that. But I, you know, for me, I'm actually living in New York City half the year now, and I'm going back into the prisons. I'm starting, as of this next month, which is October, actually, I'm going to be starting a new writing workshop at Bayview, the only women's correctional facility in Manhattan. Happens to be right by Chelsea Piers. And I went in there years ago. We did a poetry class. In fact, Amiri Baraka came in with us. And it's like we had Cheever come into Sing Sing one time. Anyway, that's another whole story. But, you know, we're starting this writing workshop up. So I guess you just have to go back into the fray. I want to bring some young poets with me. I really think this is also a function of, I mean, this is also a world for the young, you know, to reach out to those who are most helpless in society's grasp.
And on a different level than the questions at the beginning, knowing what you've come to know, what do you now hope to accomplish?
In teaching a writing workshop?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be exactly the same thing as that writing workshop that took place so long ago. I learned, well, look, it really helped me. I learned how to be a creative writing teacher. I've taught in many universities, but that's where I really learned how to teach creative writing, and because the women had such urgency in their writing. I want to be able to recognize that urgency again, to try to help them get it on paper, to not make them feel this is therapy, something that I have no business even talking about nor interest in, but that it is, in fact, writing. It's self-expression, and that in lying to tell the truth and, you know, telling the poem, one can actually be a version of saved.
Mm. I've been talking with Carol Musky Dukes, author most recently of Channeling Mark Twain, published by Random House. You know, it's always the case when Carol comes, we always end up very... saying more than we expected to. So thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Channeling Mark Twain at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.